Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. Carlina Renee White was born in Harlem, New York on July 15, 1987, to parents Joy White and Carl Tyson. Joy and Carl had been the first couple among their friends to have a baby. At the time, 22-year-old Carl was driving a truck and working nights in a parking garage, while 16-year-old Joy was still in high school. On August 4, 1987, less than 3 weeks after her birth, Carlina developed a high fever and her parents took her to the emergency room at the Harlem Hospital. Doctors discovered that she had an infection from swallowing fluid during her birth. Since they were going to keep her overnight, Carl went in search of a phone to call their mothers. When he looked back down the hallway, he saw Joy talking to a nurse. He then overheard her say, "The baby don't cry for you, you cry for the baby." He found the nurse's comments very strange. Joy had planned to stay with Carlina, but needed to go to her mother's home first to collect a few items. Carl then continued back to his apartment, where he fell asleep. Just as he dozed off, a call came from Joy's mother's apartment, informing him that his daughter had been abducted. Nurses at the hospital found Carlina missing at 3:40 a.m. It's thought that she was abducted sometime between 2:30 and 3:55 a.m. Unfortunately, the surveillance system in the hospital was not working at the time of the abduction. Carl couldn't stop thinking about the strange nurse he saw talking to Joy. Other witnesses at the hospital also spotted the lady and said she had been seen there for the past several weeks. It would later be revealed that the lady was not actually a nurse, but had fooled everyone, including the actual nurses at the hospital. A security guard said he saw a person matching the woman's description leave the hospital around 3:30 a.m. However, he didn't see a baby, but said she appeared heavyset, making him wonder if she was hiding the baby in her smock. In 2009, 18 years later, a senior high school student in Bridgeport, Connecticut, named Nadra Nance, became pregnant and needed her original birth certificate and Social Security card, but her mother claimed she couldn't find them. When her mother finally produced a birth certificate and Nadra attempted to submit it, officials told her it was fake. Nadra then began to question if her mother was really who she said she was. Her mother was a woman named Anne, and realizing that Nadra was about to figure out the truth, she decided to tell her another lie. She said that her biological mother didn't want her and gave her to Anne. It would be another 7 years before Nadra would finally find out that her real name was Carlina, and she had been abducted in 1987. During this time, Nadra, who was now living in Atlanta, Georgia, began searching the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's database for answers. She finally came across a picture of a baby girl named Carlina who disappeared on August 4, 1987. The photo of Carlina reminded her a lot of her own daughter. After contacting the company, the police decided to get DNA swabs from Carl, Joy, and Nadra. However, even before the results were in, she called Joy, and about a week later, Nadra flew to New York to meet her. She was greeted by multiple family members she never even knew about. When the DNA results finally came back, it proved that Nadra was really Carlina. Even though Carlina's reunion with her birth parents was a joyous occasion, the bonding was a whole different story. Her case also received national attention, and Carlina began doing interviews, but wasn't as happy as she thought she'd be. So she pulled away from her birth family and returned to Atlanta, Georgia. She had spent her entire life bonding with Anne's family and felt guilty about abandoning them for her biological family. Investigators then got to work tracking Anne down, whose full name was Anna Geta Petway. Anne had struggled with drug addiction and also had a criminal record, including charges of larceny, theft, and forgery. In 1987, Anne told her friends she was pregnant, and a friend later said Anne left town for a while before returning with a child. Friends and family assumed she'd gone elsewhere to give birth to the baby and that the father was her on-again, off-again boyfriend, Robert Nance. Carlina spent much of her childhood in Bridgeport, Connecticut, before she and Ann moved to Atlanta, Georgia. Carlina had begun to wonder if Ann was really her mother well before she got pregnant. Not only was her skin much lighter than Ann, but there was also no physical resemblance. On January 23, 2011, Anna Geta Petway turned herself into the FBI after a warrant was issued for her arrest. Anne explained that she kidnapped Carlina after suffering several miscarriages in an attempt to fill the emptiness they left behind. In the end, she pleaded guilty to one count of kidnapping and was sentenced to 12 years in prison. As for Carlina, she has since reconnected with her biological parents, but says she will always have love for Anne and her family. Latanya Carwell was born on April 17, 2001, in Palestine, Texas, and went by her middle name, Janelle. In 2017, 15-year-old Janelle was an honor student at T.W. Josie Comprehensive High School and dreamed of becoming a doctor. She lived with her mother, Tanya Tripp, and stepfather, Leon Tripp, along with her little sister in Augusta, Georgia. In 2015, Tanya married Leon while he was still in prison. After being released later that year, he moved in with her and her two daughters. On April 17, 2017, Janelle, along with her friends and family, had a cookout to celebrate her 16th birthday. After the get-together, Janelle and her parents all went to bed around midnight. Sometime during the night, Leon woke Janelle up and asked to borrow her phone. He said a friend's car had broken down and needed a ride, but he couldn't work her phone to get the directions to where the friend was. So he allegedly took Janelle with him to Clarks Hill, South Carolina. By the following day, both Janelle and Leon had failed to return, so Tanya called the police and reported them missing. The police and community members began searching for them, and Tanya even went live on Facebook, appealing to the public for her daughter's safe return. Days would turn into weeks with no sign of them. Meanwhile, investigators pulled Janelle and Leon's phone records and discovered they never actually made it to Clarks Hill. On April 26, 2017, 9 days after Janelle disappeared, Leon's car was located, but investigators found no signs of foul play. Eventually, numerous sightings of Leon would be reported, including 2 hours away in Atlanta, Georgia. Suspiciously, he was alone, and there were no reported sightings of Janelle. With the new information, the police began looking into Leon's past and discovered that some of his past criminal charges were for assault charges and cruelty to children. This immediately shot Leon to the top of the suspect list. However, Tanya kept defending Leon, saying that he would never harm Janelle. By May 1st, a couple of weeks after Janelle was reported missing, they issued a kidnapping warrant for Leon. On May 23rd, Leon was spotted at a U-Haul in Atlanta, and when police arrived, they couldn't believe what they found. Yes, Leon was there, but shockingly, so was Tanya. They were both arrested, and Leon was charged with abduction, while Tanya was charged with hindering the apprehension of a criminal. Leon then tried to claim that he and Janelle were never heading to Clarks Hill on April 17th, and instead drove to Atlanta. He said after arriving, he gave her money to take a bus back to Augusta, but never saw her again. That would prove to be a lie because on March 8, 2018, almost a year after Janelle disappeared, human remains were uncovered in a shallow grave in the backyard of a vacant home off Golden Camp Road in Augusta, not far from where the family lived. Dental records confirmed the body belonged to Janelle. She had been bound and beaten to death. The motive behind the murder is still unknown. However, some believe that Tanya was jealous of her daughter. When News Channel 6 asked Tanya if Leon and Janelle had secretly been in a relationship, she responded, "He married to all this prettiness, and he's gonna run away with our daughter? Come on now, that's stupid." It was then discovered that Leon and Tanya had unsuccessfully tried to hire a hitman more than 3 times to kill Janelle. In November of 2023, 6 years after her murder, Leon and Tanya were charged with Janelle's murder, aggravated assault, first-degree cruelty to children, and concealing the death of another. Both of them have pleaded not guilty and are currently awaiting trial. Nancy Jo McEvers was born on October 16, 1954, in Portland, Oregon. At the age of 28, Nancy was living in the Durham neighborhood of the then unincorporated Washington County, Oregon, with her husband, Randall McEvers, who went by Randy, and their one-year-old son. Nancy was described as a quiet and beautiful person who loved being a mom. On January 2, 1983, Randy called 911 and claimed that Nancy had taken her own life. When deputies arrived, they found Nancy with a gunshot wound to the head. She was rushed to the hospital, where she was sadly pronounced dead. When Randy spoke to deputies on the scene, he strangely provided two different versions of events that led up to the shooting, and detectives were called in to investigate further. The first version was that there was a struggle over the gun and that he was unsure who pulled the trigger. He then contradicted himself by saying that he walked into a room in their home as Nancy shot herself. Forensics determined that Nancy had no gunshot residue on her hands and that the distance between the gun's muzzle and Nancy's wound was too high to be consistent with her pulling the trigger herself. They also found charred particles on her clothing that indicated she tried to defend herself. At this point, the evidence clearly showed she had not taken her own life. Randy's parents met with investigators and agreed to have him take a polygraph, but he never did. By April of 1983, 3 months later, Randy had stopped cooperating with investigators. They continued to work the case until it was shelved in August 1983, 8 months after her murder, citing a lack of leads. Years later, a new team on the case would say that her death was very poorly investigated. Investigators had maintained to the family that her death was not the result of foul play, something they believed for years, even though they had suspicions of Randy's involvement. In August of 2022, the Washington County Violent Crimes Unit decided to re-examine the case. This team is the one who realized that the investigation into her death in 1983 was very inadequate. As the new team continued to investigate her murder, they found many sources that said Randy had planned on killing Nancy for wanting a divorce. They continued interviewing people involved in the case in 1983 and were also able to collect numerous new items of evidence. Investigators tracked Randy down in Tigard, Oregon, and interviewed him. During the interview, he claimed he had gone to hypnotherapy and they were able to wipe the events of that day out of his mind. This was most likely a last-ditch effort by Randy to stay a free man, but he most likely knew nobody would buy that story. Weeks later, on February 8, 2023, with him probably seeing the writing on the wall, he took his own life. This case is now officially closed, with Randy listed as her murderer. While it might not be the justice her family was looking for, they are thankful to finally have some long-awaited answers. On September 15, 1994, inmates working on the side of Interstate 10 in Holt, Florida, found human skeletal remains. Experts determined the remains belonged to a white female between the ages of 35 and 55. She was found with a full-length floral pattern button-up dress, a floral print jacket, and several pieces of jewelry. In February 1996, Keith Jesperson, aka Happy Face Killer, admitted to an Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office investigator that he was responsible for killing a Jane Doe in August 1994 and dumping her body near an exit on Interstate 10. He said he picked her up near Tampa in August of 1994 and began traveling across the Florida Panhandle. When they stopped at a rest area, Jesperson parked next to a security guard while the female was sleeping on his mattress. He went and sat on the mattress next to her, and she began freaking out and screaming and wouldn't stop. Jesperson said the more he told her to shut up, the more she screamed. Since he wasn't allowed to have unauthorized riders in his truck and didn't want to draw the security guard's attention, he began pushing his fist against her neck until she could no longer breathe. After she was initially passed out, he placed zip ties around her throat, which is what ultimately killed her. After that, he dumped her body off Interstate 10. He said he believed her name was either Susan, Suzanne, or Suzette. Even with that information, it would still take another 30 years to identify the female. Over the years, multiple attempts, including enhanced facial reconstruction and isotope analysis, were made to try and identify the female, but they all led nowhere. Finally, in 2022, the medical examiner's office teamed up with Othram, And by October 2023, her identification was finally revealed as 34-year-old Suzanne Schellenberg. Suzanne was born on October 8, 1959, to Marilyn and Evan, who was a third-generation prominent lawyer. In 1977, she graduated from North Shore County Day School in Winnetka, Illinois. In 1994, at the time of her murder, she was an unemployed drifter. Her family said they are very thankful for the long-awaited closure. As for 68-year-old Jesperson, he claims to have killed upwards of 160 women over the years, but this has never been confirmed. He has since been charged with the murder of Suzanne. On July 3, 1989, a bulldozer was clearing debris at the Spokane Northside landfill in Spokane, Washington, when he spotted something that appeared to be human remains. When he got out and took a closer look, that was exactly what it was. The body was that of a white male wearing blue pants, a blue jacket, and a light-colored shirt. He had visible injuries, including skin tears and broken bones. At the time, the landfill was open to anyone from the public and only maintained by employees every 2 to 3 weeks. While the man's injuries were certainly suspicious, an autopsy revealed they were most likely caused by the bulldozer. Unfortunately, due to the decomposition, the cause of death could not be determined. Plus, his face was unrecognizable, and fingerprints could not be obtained, so there wasn't a good way to identify him. However, a forensic pathologist estimated the age of the man to be between 40 and 60 years old. The FBI was eventually brought in, and they were able to retrieve the man's fingerprints, but there were no matches in the database. The man's teeth were also compared against missing persons records, but once again, there were no matches. The man would remain unidentified for the next 34 years and became known as Spokane County John Doe. In 2004, the medical examiner sent tissue samples from the man's skull to the FBI. From there, they were able to obtain a mitochondrial DNA sequence from the man's mother's bloodline. That DNA was then uploaded to several different genealogical databases. In 2008, more samples were sent, and they were able to develop a DNA profile from both sides of the man's family. Even with this, it would still take another 15 years to identify the man. In 2023, the medical examiner sent the evidence to Othram, and with the help of their in-house forensic genetic genealogy team, they were able to provide investigators with some promising leads. This led investigators to the man's son, but unfortunately, he had been adopted at birth and never knew his father. However, he had been in the process of tracking down his biological parents and uploaded his DNA profile to a genetic genealogy database. He had also done some extensive family tree research and was able to provide investigators with a family name and a possible lead on who his father may have been. Investigators were then able to track down the sister of the unidentified man, and she agreed to provide a DNA sample for reference testing. Finally, in October of 2023, the man was identified as 44-year-old Clifford Wayne Bibbs. Clifford was born in Teco, Washington on September 25, 1943, the oldest of three siblings. He served in the U.S. Army, and his sister last saw him about 6 months before his death. She was unable to reach him for several months and reported him missing in January 1990 after he failed to call or visit on her birthday. She searched for him extensively but was never able to find him. After exhausting all other avenues, she placed a headstone honoring him, listing his date of death as April 1991. At this time, the Spokane Police Department does not believe Cliff's death was criminal in nature, but they hope if someone has information on him and his death, they will come forward. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time.